Mr. D'Alessandro a note. I didn't think it would bother him, but I did want to double-check with him. He does say thank you very much for all the prayers and phone calls and cards that he's received. But I sent him an email yesterday saying, please forgive me. My topic was prepared and sermon written prior to your announcement. So he got a little bit of a chuckle out of that and gave me full permission to talk about what I'm going to talk about. But the coincidence is purely that. It is just a coincidence. The human heart is amazing. It is, if you're curious about the size of the human heart, it is about the size of your two hands clasped together. If you're a child, it's more about the size of your fist. It's located, most people, for example, when we sing the national anthem, most people will put their hand over their heart. It's not there. It's located more in the center. So if you are one who puts your hand over your heart when the national anthem is being sung, don't do it over here. You need to put it more in the center. It beats 100,000 times per day. It will beat, on average, 2.5 billion times over a person's lifetime. It will pump 1 million barrels of blood during the average person's lifetime. If you want to try to equate to how much that is, that's the equivalent of taking your kitchen faucet and turning it on all the way and then letting it run for 45 years. That is the amount of blood that your heart will pump during an average lifetime. Every cell inside of your body needs oxygen. It needs oxygen in order to live and to function. And the role of the heart is to deliver that oxygen-rich blood to every cell that is inside the body. And if you're curious how many you might have of those, it's about 75 trillion. There's only one part of the body, this is just a little piece of trivia, there's only one part of the body that does not receive blood from the heart. Does anybody know? No? No one will guess it. Your corneas on your eyes. That is the only part of the human body that does not receive blood. But diseases that are related to the heart kill over 1 million people per year in the United States. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in America. At least 55.8 million people in this country currently suffer from some form of heart disease. Every 34 seconds, a person in the United States dies from a heart-related disease. That's more than 2,500 people each day. There are almost 6 million people hospitalized each year for a cardiovascular disease. And since 1900, cardiovascular disease has been the number one killer in the United States. Since 1900, with the exception of 1 year, which was 1918. But every other year since 1900, it has been the number one killer in the United States. So we can, of course, have a healthy heart, we can have a good heart, we can have a bad heart. We need to be aware, of course, of the state of our health, what that is right now. And there are, of course, conditions itself that produce heart problems. Too little exercise. You know, if you're a couch potato, very little activity, that can contribute to a poor heart. Of course, our diet. You know, in the United States, unfortunately, our diet is very high in fats. In fact, the average American diet, 40% of what we intake is considered to be bad fats. So that contributes to it. Overweight. Stress, of course, can be a contributor. If the person's under a lot of stress due to work or due to family conditions, other personal issues that they're battling, that can certainly contribute to a poor heart condition. And then, of course, there is a genetic predisposition. Some people just simply have that, which contributes to it as well. But heart disease itself, it can cripple. It can handicap. Ultimately, it could potentially kill us. You know, could we have a heart attack? Could we have a spiritual heart attack? How sound right now is our spiritual heart? Could we be suffering from spiritual heart disease because of whatever contributing factors might be out there. What makes us have a sound, healthy spiritual heart? How can you tell if your heart is not sound? Those are the things that that I'd like to cover today. So notice why, you know, of course we know the story of the flood, but notice why God had to bring the flood onto the earth. Why did he feel it necessary to destroy everyone in the flood, with the exception of Noah and his family? Why did he feel that that was necessary? We see that in Genesis 6 and verse 5. Genesis 6 and verse 5 says, "Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." It was the condition of man's heart at that time that God felt it was necessary to destroy the earth. Because at that point, man was thinking on nothing but evil. You know, enough so that God just felt, I've got to start over again. That's how bad it is, because of what was inside man's heart at that point in time. The inclination, the intent that they had was a heart of evil. And of course, as we know, the times that Noah went through, those are compared to the end times as well, that it'll be very difficult, that ultimately man's heart in the end times will also be focused completely on evil. You know, we see much of that today in various forms. May not be completely on evil yet, but we certainly see a lot of examples of where man's heart right now is set on evil, focused on evil ways, things that go contrary to what God teaches, what God expects of us. And we see all of that, obviously, because man was ultimately cut off. He was cut off from the tree of life and instead chose to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So we see that. A couple of chapters later, Genesis 8, verse 21. When does it start? Actually, apropos with what Mr. Dunham was talking about today as well. But Genesis 8 and verse 21. "And the Lord smelled a soothing aroma. Then the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground for man's sake, although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Nor will I again destroy every living thing as I have done." So much of that, of what starts in a man's heart, as Mr. Dunham was talking about, starts at the home. You know, it's something that is learned from youth at that point. Something that can start at a very young age. That seed is planted and it grows depending on what type of environment it's found in. So it starts at a very, very young age. Matthew chapter 15. Matthew 15, starting in verse 7. "Hypocrites, well did Isaiah prophesy about you, saying, these people draw near to me with their mouth and honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me." So we see here again, we see the concern here about the fact that Christ saw in man a heart that was not near God in any way, shape, or form. It was distant from God. It didn't want to be close to God. It wasn't seeking God out. It was a heart that was going contrary to everything that God expected from them. Continue on down in verse 17. "Do you not yet understand that whatever enters the mouth goes into the stomach and is eliminated? But those things which proceed out of the mouth come from the heart, and they defile a man. For out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, and blasphemies. These are the things which defile a man, but to eat with unwashed hands does not defile a man." So Christ was battling the scribes and the Pharisees because they didn't wash their hands according to the ritualistic ceremonies that they were supposed to do. And they were concerned about getting dirt and germs in their mouth. And he had to say, that's not what makes a man evil. That doesn't defile a man based on the fact that he didn't wash his hands before he ate his food. What makes a man evil is what comes out of his heart. That's where the murders, the blasphemies, the false witness, the fornication, the thefts. That's what defiles a man. It's what's inside his heart, not what's on his hands that he eats with. So that being the case, what about our spiritual diet? You know, the spiritual diet of this world, it comes from Satan. He is the one who is concocting all these different recipes for us. You know, he is this master chef who has all these different things, and he knows what people like to eat spiritually, and so he makes them up a meal, and he feeds it to them, and we eat it. And that's ultimately what's going to potentially give us that spiritual heart disease, that spiritual heart attack. He is that master chef. He serves up a lot of different things because he serves it up in attitudes. He serves it up in approaches. He serves it up in wrong desires that we might have, temptations. You know, the way that we abuse fleshly desires or the motives that we have. He serves all of these things up knowing that, that tastes good. That pizza tastes good. You know, as an example, the other night I told Lori, okay, once again, I'm going to be really good, and you're making homemade pizza, which I love homemade pizza, but I'm going to tough it out. And so the best thing is I had some errands to do while they were eating their homemade pizza, and I came home, and I'm like, okay, I'll cut the grass. I won't eat any homemade pizza. That'll distract me. And then the lawnmower breaks. So then I'm trying to find on YouTube what's going on with the lawnmower, and I have to walk through the kitchen to get from the backyard to where my computer is. And what's there but the homemade pizza, right, cooling down so that they can put it up in the and I'm like, oh, just one piece. I'm just going to have one piece. So I have my piece, and I go to my computer, and I do my work, and then I'm walking out to the backyard, and it's still there, and I'm like, I'm just going to have one more piece. And suddenly, four pieces later, I've had my pizza that I wasn't supposed to have. But that's what Satan does. He knows this is going to taste really good, and it's hard for me to turn it down. And he knows all of those different things. But what he is serving up is very, very high in spiritual fat. It's not the healthy fat. This is the bad fat. This is the high in calories. The one where, you know, when you go out to dinner and you say, I can feel my arteries being clogged as I am eating this. That is what he is serving up. Every time that we eat that spiritual junk food, the lust of the eyes, the pride of the life, we're putting our spiritual heart in danger when we do that. Ephesians chapter 2. Ephesians 2, we'll read verses 2 and 3. In which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience, among whom also we all once conducted ourselves in the lusts of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, just as the others. So again, Satan is constantly working at this, constantly working on a diet of disobedience, one that allows us to eat this forbidden fruit, this one that feeds on the flesh, on the mind. He is constantly trying to feed this to us nonstop. And the influences of society is the way that he does it. The influences, again, of attitudes, the influences of approaches. You know, what's put before us visually, what we see, what we hear, all of this is Satan's way of hopefully killing us by a spiritual heart attack. That's what he would love to see. And we become defiled, again, not by what goes into our mouth, but what is in our hearts and what comes out of our hearts. The Hastings New Testament Dictionary defines heart as this. Heart is the word most commonly used to denote the inner nature of man, the secret core of his being, where the springs of his intellectual and moral activity reside. Originally employed to designate the bodily organ, which is the center of the animal life, it came by a natural process of thought to be applied to the invisible center of the thinking and responsible life. So when we see these examples of heart in the Bible, it's our core. It's where our morals are. It's where our thoughts lie. It's what we tend to focus on, where we put all of our effort. You know, what we might become passionate about. So knowing that, let's take a look at Matthew 13. Matthew 13, and we'll read verses 13 through 15. Therefore I speak to them in parables, because seeing they do not see, and hearing they do not hear, nor do they understand. And in them the prophecy of Isaiah is fulfilled, which says, hearing you will hear and shall not understand, and seeing you will see and not perceive. For the hearts of this people have grown dull. Their ears are hard of hearing, and their eyes they have closed, lest they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears, lest they should understand with their hearts and turn, so that I should heal them. So again, now understanding that meaning of heart, you know, not talking about the physical muscle inside of our chest wall, but more, what is our core? Where is our morals? Where is our compass? Looking at this, it talks about the fact that the heart of this people has grown dull. The Greek word for that actually means to make thick, or to fat, or fatten, which is very apropos when you compare it to what can happen to the human heart when somebody has heart disease, for example. You know, the arteries get clogged, the heart walls can thicken over time, and ultimately that can lead to a heart attack and death. And Christ is talking about that here. Their heart, their spiritual heart, has grown dull. It's grown fat. It doesn't perform as efficiently as it should. And that condition itself, of course, can lead to spiritual death. We can have a spiritual hardening of the arteries. Again, they get clogged up to where the body doesn't perform as it should. The heart doesn't perform as it should. It doesn't get the rest of the body that oxygen-rich blood that it needs to survive. It just can't work. It's too difficult for it to do. And those who resist God ultimately are hardening their hearts to the point where they won't beat anymore. They won't work. It's a stubborn approach. It's a very unrepentant approach when you have that kind of a heart inside of you. What is the human heart like naturally? These will kind of come at you a little bit rapid fire. So if you want, you can just jot them down and I'll read them for you. First one, Psalm 39 and verse 5. Indeed, you have made my days as handbreadths, and my age is as nothing before you. Certainly every man at his best state is but vapor. Jeremiah 17 and verse 9. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Isaiah 64 and verse 6. But we are all like an unclean thing, and our unrighteousness, all our righteousness, are like filthy rags. We all fade as a leaf, and our iniquities, like the wind, have taken us away. Finally, Romans 8 and verse 7. Because the carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God, nor indeed can be. So that's our starting point. We're a vapor. We are unrighteous. We are as filthy rags. We are enmity against God, the starting point that we have. So we're pretty sick. You know, there's some concern right now. There's some test results that have come back that have given the physicians some pause and saying this is something that we need to look at a little bit deeper, find out what's going on. But the nice thing is that the human heart itself, it can be healed. You know, when you look at the physical heart and what happens, there's a number of procedures that can be done that can help by the medical professions. You know, of course, you have the bypass surgery that could happen. That could help the person. You have stents that can be put in. My mom has a stent. She had one put in, I don't know what it was, maybe 10, 15 years ago now. She actually found her own blockage. She was at a pharmacy, and you know they have those machines where you can kind of sit down and stick your arm in, and you push the button and it tells you what your blood pressure is. And she did that, and she took her blood pressure, and it was astronomically low. And so she goes up to the pharmacist and says, "I think your machine's broken." And he says, "Well, actually, we just had that calibrated. What was your results?" And I don't know what the exact numbers were, but it was dangerously low. And he said, "Do you feel faint? Do you feel, you know, do you feel like you're going to pass out?" And nope, nope. So, of course, he suggested you need to go see your doctor. So she goes and sees the doctor. And it winds up the entire time that she's going to see her doctor, they always take the blood pressure on the left arm. And the machine happened to be on the right. They never took it on the other arm. So everything's fine over here, but her blockage was over here. And so by chance, I guess you could say maybe chance, she found her own issue. Wound up ultimately having surgery and having a stent put in. So that can be done. Of course, you can have the balloons, angioplasty. They'll come in and blow it up and flatten the clogged arteries, the fatty deposits. But of course, in the most severe cases, you may have to have a heart transplant. If you can find that donor, they can do that. Hopefully the body wouldn't reject it, and it would adopt it, and it would become a healthy heart for the individual. But then, of course, after all of that, you've got some changes that you need to make. You know, of course, you need to probably more than likely change your diet. You know, not as high fats, more fruits, more vegetables, lean meats, all the healthy stuff that we're supposed to be doing as well. Exercise, walks, runs, whatever you have the ability to do, just make sure that you're mobile and in action. God actually starts with surgery. That's his first option. Ezekiel chapter 36. Ezekiel 36, and we'll read verses 25 through 27. "Then I will sprinkle clean water on you, and you shall be clean. I will cleanse you from all your filthiness and from all your idols. I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit within you. I will take the heart of stone out of your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes, and you will keep my judgments and do them." So God starts with a very radical procedure. He doesn't do medication. He doesn't do bypass surgery or angioplasty. He goes right for the heart transplant. And he gives us a new heart. He puts a new heart within us. He puts a new spirit within us, one that replaces the heart of stone that we have, and he gives us a heart of flesh. You know, and he doesn't give us the spirit of this world, not what it is that Satan feeds this world. He gives us his spirit. The nature of God then dwells in us. He even cleans us up a little bit before surgery, right? He sprinkles water on you before it, just like they do in the physical. They go through and they wash their hands and everything is sterilized. He even makes sure he does that. Romans chapter 2. Verses 28 and 29. "For he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, nor is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh, but he is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, not in the letter, whose praise is not from men, but from God." So here we see now a New Testament comparison to another different type of surgery, circumcision, but it's a different analogy, but it's the same meaning behind that. You know, when we are converted, God cuts away that hostility that we have. He cuts away our unrepentant attitude, our self-will, the hardness of our heart, you would say, by giving us that new heart of flesh. And hopefully we are willing then to give up our way, right? We're willing to put God first. We're willing to change our diet. We're willing to exercise more. once God gives us that new heart, we need to do the things to make sure that our heart remains healthy, that we don't have those same issues that we had before. Romans 6. In verse 6, knowing this, that our old man was crucified with him, that the body of sin might be done away, that we should no longer be slaves to sin. Down to verse 12, therefore do not let sin reign in your mortal body, that you should obey in it its lusts. Down to verse 14, for sin shall not have dominion over you, for you are not under law but under grace. Verse 16, do you not know that to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey, you are that one slaves whom you obey, whether of sin leading to death or of obedience leading to righteousness? But God be thanked that though you were slaves of sin, yet you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine to which you were delivered. And having been set free from sin, you became slaves of righteousness. So after we have this transplant, after God gives us this new heart of flesh and we have this new spirit, there are things that we have to do. And hopefully at that point in time, sin no longer dominates us at that point. We have been changed. We are a new person. We are now a healthy person, hopefully, and we need to do everything we can to maintain our spiritual health. And what God has done is He has taken that grip that Satan has on us through the diet that He's been feeding us, and He breaks it. He breaks that grip for us. And then, just like any other good physician, He's got recommendations for us. He changes our diet. So just like a physician is going to come in and say, you can't eat like you used to, God does the same thing. You need to change your spiritual diet. Hebrews chapter 4. Hebrews 4 and verses 12 and 13. For the word of God is living and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the division of soul and spirit and of joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. And there is no creature hidden from his sight, but all things are naked and open to the eyes of him to whom we must give account. So we now feed on God's word. That is our diet change. We are no longer bringing in this spiritual fat, this spiritual unhealthiness, but we are now taking in the good, healthy food that keeps our spiritual heart beating and pumping as it should. We have different standards now that we have to live by. Our minds are no longer supposed to be filled with things of this world, things that Satan puts out there. Our mind is supposed to be filled with things of God, spiritual things, our spiritual attitudes, our spiritual approaches, spiritual thoughts, desires, bringing every thought into captivity, protecting what goes into our minds, what goes into our hearts, so that we don't get sick again. We get away from the fast foods of this world. And we grow. You know, when you have a healthy heart, especially when you're young, and it beats that blood through the body grows. It gets bigger. It gets stronger. And our spiritual heart should be doing the same thing. We should be becoming stronger as a spiritual body, as a spiritual person. It is one of maturity. And if you think about it, a doctor, for example, if somebody's sick and they go into the hospital with heart disease and they have some type of a procedure, a doctor is never going to say, okay, you need to change your diet, but you only need to change it on Thursdays. It's okay to eat all the junk food 6 days a week as long as on Thursdays you eat the healthy food. You're not going to hear them say that. You're not going to hear them say you need to eat healthy 2 days a week or you need to eat healthy 4 days a week. You need to eat healthy from that point moving forward. You can't go back to, I'm going to eat partial good food and I'm going to eat partial bad food, because you'll run into the same situation that you were before. And again, same thing. We cannot think that we can get by on partaking of the Word of God a couple of times a week. It's not going to sustain us. It's something that we have to do on a daily basis. If we want to be physically, spiritually, I should say, healthy, we need to eat spiritually healthy every day. It's something that we have to do. The doctor is also going to tell you that you can't just eat good. You know, you can't just eat fruit and carrots and then sit on the couch and watch TV for 5 hours every night. You've got to get up. You've got to get active, and you have to exercise. And that's something we will have to do as well. 1 Timothy 4 and verse 8. For bodily exercise profits a little, but godliness is profitable for all things, having promise of the life that now is and of that which is to come. So we now have the responsibility of exercising. And what we have to exercise is godliness. Again, the same thing on a regular, ongoing basis. It's something that we can't, you know, as Mr. Dunham talked about, it's not something we can simply practice for the 3 or 4 hours that we're here today. It's something that we have to practice on a continual, daily basis. The thing about exercise is that the more you do it, the actual easier it becomes. I joined a gym back in January. I know you can't tell, but that's because I only changed one aspect of my life. I only changed the physical exercise part. I haven't changed the diet part yet. So that is still there. I need to correct that, and I need to change the diet. However, the physical exercise part, that first day, the trainer that I have is 27, and he's 6'3", and he's probably 270 pounds, and he's this huge barrel-chested guy. And if you've ever seen it, the movie Twins, when Arnold Schwarzenegger, when he changed into that T-shirt, and then Danny DeVito asks, "Are you having some sort of allergic reaction? Because you seem to be all swelled up." That's my trainer. And the first times that I went to him, I was so unbelievably sore for days. Just to climb up and down stairs was excruciatingly painful. And my heart's beating a million miles a minute during the exercise. And you're thinking, certainly we have to be done. And you look over the clock, and you've only been doing it for 5 minutes. You're like, I've got 25 more minutes to go of this. But the thing is that when I started that, I remember the weights that I was using, right? And you're using either 10-pound weights or you're using 20-pound weights. And, you know, you're like, these things weigh a million pounds. Now, 6-7 months later, now it's 60-pound weights and it's 80-pound weights. And it's not as hard. And suddenly now you don't have as much pain the next day as you used to. And so in other words, the more you do it, when it gets into a routine, it almost somewhat gets easier. And it's something that you almost feel guilty if you don't exercise. And that's where we need to get to spiritually. If we don't exercise spiritually on a regular basis, it's going to be hard. It's going to be painful. But to be honest, if it's something that we do on a regular basis and we get past, we push ourselves past that hill and we get up to that top, after that point it becomes much easier to do. It becomes part of our life. It becomes habit. And it's something that we feel guilty about when we don't do it. And that's the position that we want to get to. And of course, there are going to be times where we slip back into our old ways, right? We're going to have that piece of chocolate cake. We're going to have what we thought was going to be one piece of pizza that turned into four, only because I couldn't figure out what was wrong with the lawnmower and had to keep going back in and out of the house. So we're going to do that. And there are times we may have to go back to the doctor and he's got to do something else. You know, and those are things that will happen. And there may be times, there probably will be times when we have to do that spiritually, where we stopped exercising for a while, where we stopped eating of the good food, and maybe we started eating the bad food again. But the great thing is that we have that position that we can go back to, you know, and fix me. Sorry. Sorry I did this. I went against your way. I repent. Please forgive me and fix whatever went wrong with my heart. Joel chapter 2. Joel chapter 2, we'll read verses 12 through 14. Now therefore, says the Lord, turn to me with all your heart, with fasting, with weeping, and with mourning. So rend your heart, and not your garments. Return to the Lord your God, for he is gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and of great kindness, and he relents from doing harm. Who knows if he will turn and relent and leave a blessing behind him, a grain offering and a drink offering for the Lord your God. So it says that we are to rend our hearts and not our garments. The pulpit's commentary has this about this particular phrase. It says, where there is real contrition of spirit because of sin, outward manifestations are both suitable and proper, though not by way of display or for sake of ostentation. But they were reminded, on the other hand, that mere outward manifestations avail nothing unless there also exists the deep inward feelings which are in harmony with and naturally underlie those manifestations. Out of such inward feelings, those outward expressions properly originate. Hence, after the exhortation to fasting and weeping and mourning, it is added, rend your heart and not your garments. To rend the garments among the Jews was a token of great grief, and it imported that the individual who did so was overwhelmed with excessive sorrow or had encountered some terrible calamity. Thus we read of Jacob, on receiving his son Joseph's coat of many colors, rending his clothes or tearing his clothes, putting sackcloth on his loins, and mourning for his son many days. In these instances, the sorrow was deep and genuine and bitter. It was possible, however, to exhibit the external signs of grief without any such corresponding inward feeling of sorrow. Just as it is still possible for men to draw near to God with their lips while the heart is far from him. To prevent such hypocritical pretense, they are commanded to rend their hearts and not their garments only. So when we do this, it should tear at our hearts. You know, when we go against God and what he says and his laws, it should be more than just an outward showing to impress other people. You know, it should be something that we deep down in our hearts feel and know. And of course, as is mentioned here, fasting is one way that we can come before God and he can help clean up our heart. You know, it's interesting, if you look at physical fasting, I got this from the Men's Journal. They're discovering over the past couple of decades the benefits of actually fasting. Now, of course, we fast on atonement, and I'm sure we fast many times throughout the year as well. But they're now beginning to understand that there are a lot of physical benefits to fasting. So, according to some recent studies, it helps with weight loss. Obviously, not how you think, because you're not taking in food and therefore you lose weight. It actually helps with weight loss because your body's natural production of growth hormones spikes during a fast. So your own human growth hormone, when you're fasting, actually increases, which helps speed up metabolism, which ultimately helps with the reduction of weight. And they've been showing that actually partial fasts are beneficial as well. So they noticed that if people partial fast, and what they mean by that is one day a week, they might reduce their calorie intake to 500 or 600 calories. So not a complete fast, but just reduce it from the normal 2,000 down to 500, they say. Lost 14% more weight than those people who kept a steady 2,000 calorie diet. It was a significant amount for what really is not a significant sacrifice. To go down to 500 or 600 calories a day is something that many people have the ability to do, especially when you add water to that. There have been studies that have shown that fasting itself can help not only prevent, but is a great treatment for some forms of cancer. There was one that was done by the University of California, where it says, when the brain goes under energy restriction, i.e. when it's fasting, we see neural activity that's associated with protection against degeneration from stroke and aging. So when the body fasts, it goes into a natural protection mode, and it actually creates things which protect against dementia, which protect against things like Alzheimer's, those type of things in the mind. Fasting increases BDNF, which is a protein that's crucial for learning and protection against age-related cognitive decline. So there's now all this, you know, of course it's funny how science always somehow, someday, eventually proves what God already says works. So now we have science is now saying that there's a lot of benefits physically, health-wise, to fasting. Of course, fasting is for the purpose of getting close to God, to humbling ourselves, to hopefully attuning ourselves to what His will is, to try to understand what it is that He is looking for. And when we need forgiveness, we can go before God in fasting. When we are looking for mercy, when we're looking for deliverance, when we're looking for His help, it's a wonderful way that we can draw closer to God, and we can get our hearts back aligned with what it is, where He can fix our hearts to come before Him like that. It helps with our attitude. Not only our attitudes about ourselves and our relationship with God, but it also is a way to help align our hearts properly about our attitudes with others. Again, as Mr. Dunham was saying, the need to serve each other as brothers and sisters in Christ. Fasting is a great way that aligns our heart to make sure that we properly do that as well. 1 Kings chapter 21. First Kings 21, we'll read verses 25 through 29. But there was no one like Ahab, who sold himself to do wickedness in the sight of the Lord, because Jezebel, his wife, stirred him up. And he behaved very abominably in following idols, according to all that the Amorites had done, whom the Lord had cast out before the children. So here we're talking about the worst of the worst. Right, we have King Ahab. Verse 27, so it was when Ahab heard those words that he tore his clothes, again, rent his clothes and put sackcloth on his body and fasted and lay in sackcloth and went about mourning. And the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite saying, see how Ahab has humbled himself before me? Because he has humbled himself before me, I will not bring the calamity in his days. In the days of his son, I will bring the calamity on his house. So Ahab genuinely humbled himself. He rended his heart. It really, really bothered him when he heard those type of things. And he fasted. And he went before God in a very humble attitude. And that's a quality that we all need to strive for. It's a quality that we all need to not only hopefully have that one time when we're fasting, but something that we can maintain moving forward. You know, it should be the basis of our approach towards God. Humility, and it should be our basis for the way that we approach our interactions and relationship with each other. We do have some very good individuals in the Bible where we know what their heart was, what their condition of their heart was. It was a proper condition of the heart. First and foremost, we have Jesus Christ. Matthew chapter 11. Matthew 11, verses 28 through 29. Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. So Jesus Christ's heart was in the perfect place. It was gentle. It was meek. He was humble. He was not vain. He never exalted himself. He always pointed to God the Father. He always gave God the Father the credit. He never questioned God's authority. He knew that he was under God the Father's authority. The heart that he had was a perfect heart. Notice what he taught. Matthew chapter 5. In verse 8, so we have the Beatitudes. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. And again, these are the words of Jesus Christ. So pure in heart is what we should be striving for, not involving ourselves in this diet, again, that Satan puts out in this world, this sickness, this grotesque things that we see that this offers, whether that could be TV, it could be movie, it could be internet, it could be music, whatever it might be, that's something that is not pure of heart. We need to protect our heart from that kind of grotesque, unhealthy food. That's what will give us the spiritual heart disease. Verse 28. But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So, again, teaching us the fact that he has come to expand on the law. So it's no longer just that physical, you can do this, you cannot do this. Now, he's going to put a little bit of a oomph into it. And now, if it's in here, it's the same thing. If you lust after a woman, you've already committed adultery with her in your heart. If you hate your brother, you've already committed murder in your heart. So Christ teaches that's where it comes from. Again, it's not going back to what we talked about. It's not about the physical washing of the hands. It's about what's inside of us. That's what can defile us, and that's what ultimately can lead to our spiritual death, our spiritual heart attack. Matthew chapter 6. Verse 19 through 21. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart is also. So I don't have my Bible. It's kind of tough to write notes in this one. But in my Bible at home, there was a sermon that I was listening to where I circled the word treasure. You know, the speaker said treasure and replaced it with the word time. Where do you spend your time? Where are your passions? Because that's where your treasure is. If you spend your time at work and too much work, that's where your treasure is. If it's in front of the TV, if it's in front of video games, if it's wherever it might be, wherever you spend your time, where your passion is where your heart is. And it should be with God. Not saying that we can't obviously do other things, but where's our priorities? Where's our heart? Where is it that we put our focus? Where do we focus our attention to? That really indicates the direction that our life is taking. You know, if we have most of our time, again, focused on work, and we spend more time with work than we do with anything else, the other more important priorities in life, then that's where our life is heading ultimately. That's where our passion is. If we have a cause, you know, if there's something that you feel really important about, you know, whether it could be, you know, maybe you're trying to fight homelessness or you're trying to fight hunger or you're trying to fight some type of a disease and you're passionate about that, you know, you'll go door to door and you'll raise money and you'll go and you'll collect food and you'll go and put it in boxes, and all of that is wonderful. But do you have as much passion for God's truth and for God's way of life and for the work that he has, that he wants us to do? Our heart needs to be there first and foremost. It needs to be focused on God and God's way of life, and make sure that that is a priority in our life. Luke chapter 18. And many times doing those type of things is a way of demonstrating God's love, God's way of life, when we do those type of things. But we need to make sure that we also have the right focus. Luke chapter 8 and verse 15. Again, what is Christ teaching us? Oops, that's 18. But the ones that fell on the good ground are those who, having heard the word with a noble and good heart, keep it and bear fruit with patience. Again, getting back to the fact that once we have this new heart that God gives us, we should grow. We should be fertile ground for God's truth. We should have an honest, we should have a good heart. Matthew chapter 22. Verses 36 and 37. And all of this has been red letter so far. Jesus said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment." Again, showing the fact that the heart is involved, our moral center, where it is that we spend our time, where we focus, what are we passionate about, ties into the fact that first and foremost, we should demonstrate our love towards God. A second example we have, of course, Jesus Christ is the perfect example for us in all things, but a second example we have was King David. In Acts chapter 13, Acts 13, verses 21 and 22. "And afterward they asked for a king. So God gave them Saul, the son of Kish, a man of the tribe of Benjamin, for 40 years. And when he had removed him, he raised up for them David as king, to whom also he gave testimony and said, 'I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart, who will do all my will.'" That is what we should be striving for. To have God say that Brian is a man after my own heart should be the ultimate goal. You know, I was thinking about this last night. Why it popped in the head, I don't know if it's a great analogy, but it's one that I thought about. If you're a baseball fan, this will mean something to you. If you're not, sorry, just tune out for the next 30 seconds. So Justin Verlander, who is a pitcher for the Tigers, once said that his entire focus was on the Hall of Fame. He said, I don't care about the Cy Young Awards. I don't care about the MVPs or any of those other type of awards. If I focus on the Hall of Fame, those other things will fall into place. And that's almost kind of what I equated this to, where if we focus on the kingdom of God, and we focus on having God say that Brian is a man after my own heart, those other things will have naturally fallen into place for God to say that. And that's what ultimately I want to hear. I want to hear God say that Brian is a man after my own heart. That's what I'd like the words to hear. But why was he a man after God's own heart? That last sentence where it says in verse 22, "A man after my own heart who will do all my will." That's what defined David as a man after God's own heart, was the fact that he was willing to do whatever God's will was. And that's the attitude that we need to have as well. Whatever God's will is for me, whatever he needs me to do, I will do it. That's the heart that I want to have towards God and towards Jesus Christ. 1 Samuel 16 and verse 7. "But the Lord said to Samuel, 'Do not look at his appearance or at his physical stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord does not see as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart.'" So again, that is what God is looking for. What type of a heart do we have? David had a good heart. He had the heart that God was looking for because he was willing doing whatever God willed. Jesus Christ had a good heart. And ultimately, the reason they had that, we find in Psalm verse 40, Psalm chapter 40. The 40th Psalm, verses 6 through 8. Again, why did they have a good heart? Sacrifice and offering you do not desire. My ears you have opened. Burnt offering and sin offering you do not require. Then I said, behold, I come in the scroll and the book. It is written of me, I delight to do your will, O my God, and your law is within my heart. So again, that's what gave Jesus Christ, that's what gave King David a good heart that God was looking for, was the fact that they wanted to do God's will and the fact that they had God's law inside their heart. They didn't have a heart of stone. It had been replaced. It had been surgically removed and replaced with a heart of flesh by God, and they kept it healthy. They had a good diet. They exercised it. They kept God's law in their heart. They did what it was according to his will. So ultimately, brethren, we need to know what the state of our spiritual health is. We need to know what the state of our heart is. We need checkups. You know, we need to make sure that we go to the physician, make sure we get checkups that everything is good. We have an annual physical that we go through with God as well. In the 139th Psalm, verses 23 and 24. David writes, search me, O God. Know my heart. Try me and know my anxieties and see if there is any wicked way in me and lead me in the way of everlasting. Again, asking God to search our heart. Try to find those hidden blocked arteries that we don't know about. We don't want to find out about those too late. We want to make sure that we get those corrected as quickly as possible. So search him. You know, we need to daily ask him, show us where we're hurting. Show us where is it that I've got some weird things going on? Where do I have blockages? Where is the valves or the arteries or the veins just not working properly? Show those to me and then help me get those fixed. Our thoughts, our approaches, our attitudes, our desires, our motivations, all of that has to be right and healthy. And then if not, let's simply do what David did in Psalm 51, which asks God, create a clean heart in me.